hi, everyone. If you guys can come to the living room for the exciting interview of Scott Galloway. This is no Kara Swisher production. This is Tammy Haddon. I'm going to teach Kara how it's done. Isn't it thrilling that Scott's here?
Yeah.
In Washington. Move to Washington. Before we get started, I just want to say Linda Carter gets the Gangster Chic Award. Where are you, Linda?
Right here.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this is how it is done. This is how it is done. Okay, Scott, we're going to have a quick seat. And for those who haven't read the book yet, you can get the book right in the back there. Can you tell us what the algebra of happiness is and how you came up with it?
So first off, Tammy, Hillary, and Kara, thanks for pulling this together. It's, as per usual, thank you, but you'll take some credit, right? Anyways, so I've been to D.C. 10 times in my life, 5 times in the last 6 months, and my impression of D.C. so far is it's a bunch of incredibly nice people who get along really well. Thanks for having me. Okay, so my process, I just spoke to a couple of people who have written books. My process of writing books is very simple. I take my most popular class. I've taught 4,700 students at NYU Stern, and then I turn that one session into a video, and if the video gets a lot of views, I turn it into a book. So my second most popular session is called The Four, and it's about Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. I feel the second year of business school, I was talking to this young man, the naval surgeon who makes all of us feel safer knowing that he's out there on standing watch talking about business school. But the dirty secret of business school is the second year is largely a waste such that we can charge $140,000 in tuition instead of $70,000. And what we really should teach is just Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. So I have a class that's focused on those platforms. It's popular. Did a video, 1 million views, boom, book, the book did well. My most popular session is the last session, and it's called The Algebra of Happiness. And kids who go back to graduate school think they're going back to develop the currency for economic security, but what they're really doing is they're trying to go back to school such that they can garner the skills to develop an arc of happiness and satisfaction through their lives. And I turned this into a video. It got 2 million views. Boom, book. But it's a bit of a misnomer, the term happiness. Happiness is a sensation. It's short term. You can get happiness from Chipotle, Netflix, and Cialis. That'll get you happy in terms of a short term bump, if you will. But this is really about is trying to understand the best and worst practices around the little investments we make every day, mostly in relationships and the decisions we make, such that as we get older, we can feel like if and when we see the end, we can drop the mic, if you will. So it's really more about trying to create a narrative of satisfaction. It was a long, long answer. Sorry about that.
Well, it's a very brave book. You tell a lot.
Go on, Tammy.
No, it's true because you tell a lot. I feel like I know you really well. I got you a drink. We got the gummy bears. Your friends are here.
What kind of gummy bears?
I mean, you're doing okay, right?
Colorado?
You didn't have to. You know, the first question I asked Scott when I met him. Did you have to hire security after writing The Four? Did you guys read The Four?
So I want to be clear.
Thank you, Kara.
Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. I own their stocks. I love their products. And the book started as a love affair, a love letter to these companies. I think they're incredible, and I think they're inspiring. And I spent the better part of 2.5 years researching everything about these books, these companies. And by the end of the book, it became a cautionary tale. And in sum, I think that, or my viewpoint is that a key step to tyranny is when the government is no longer a countervailing force to private power, but becomes a co-conspirator. And I think we become overrun because of our gross idolatry of innovators and billionaires and the incredible execution and our fascination where we no longer kind of worship at the altar of character and kindness in this country, but of tech billionaires. And as a result, we're in a situation where we have, in my view, like job disruption, weaponization of our elections, monopoly power. That's the bad news. The good news is we face this problem over and over in our society. We faced it with the oil companies. We faced it with the aluminum guys. We faced it with AT&T. And every time we've solved the problem, we have a proud bipartisan history of antitrust in this country. But for some reason, this time, we seem to have lost the script. But I'm hopeful based on the reason I've been here 5 times in the last 90 days is I get calls, and this is exciting for me because I don't get these calls very often from senators who are in congressmen, and they all seem very genuine about their concern. And
right,
I feel like
do they get it? Do they understand tech companies? Because from some of the hearings, it sometimes doesn't seem that they're focused on the piece of it that would make a difference, and really what you talk about, which is really antitrust.
Yeah, so this is the bad news. 4% of our elected officials have a background in technology and engineering, and it seems like the other 96% always show up at the hearings, right? So it's, yeah, that's absolutely discouraging, but this is the same body and the same people and the same, you know, system that turned back Hitler, that figured out a cure for polio. The world isn't what it is. There's this general resignation that we can't fix this problem, that it's too late. There's 88 full-time lobbyists from Amazon in this town. Google's
complicated. And by the way, half of them are here.
But the world isn't what it is. The world is what we make of it. We can absolutely stare down this problem. If we can't solve this problem, we don't have half the metal in the backbone of our ancestors and our peers. So this is I don't think it's going to be easy, but 100% we're going to fix this, and I'm looking forward to us fixing it.
Why don't you talk about who you consider the most dangerous person in America?
Oh,
hands
down.
In the world.
Hands down. The two individuals who've done more damage to the world while making the most money are Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg.
Why?
Well, look, power corrupts. I don't think they're evil people. But when you are trying to encrypt the backbone of 2.7 billion people, a key step, as a species, we're really good at Holocausts. I know that's a fun statement, right?
Right.
And we always talk about the big one in the middle of the 20th century, but we have a tendency to do this about every 15 years around the world. And one of the key steps is control of the media. And so a diversity of media and a deconsolidation or decentralization of power and different voices in media is a key vaccination to some terrible things happening. And the first thing that happens typically when these horrible things happen is they get control of the media. Then they get control of the money, which leads to control of the military. And when you have one individual who can encrypt the backbone of the communications network and to control the algorithms that decide on the content that 2.7 billion people view, regardless of whether he's a wonderful person or not a wonderful person, you have, in my opinion, something frighteningly dangerous. And it has nothing to do with the individual. We just can't allow that to happen. I also believe we've employed lipstick on cancer with this incredibly inspiring person. And for a long time, when I was critical of Ms. Sandberg, I got criticisms of being a misogynist. And there's this weird perversion in big tech where women have to navigate this Hunger Games-like environment to get to the C-suite. But once they get there, they become a protected class. And my sense is we have to have a lot more female CEOs such that we don't have all this hand-wringing when we want to fire them. But there are few people who are more deserving of being fired than Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. These are absolutely, we're going to look back on this and think, it's hard to imagine people who've made more money while doing more damage.
Well, it's possible. That's David Chavron from the News Media Alliance, by the way, who's been trying to fight back. Well, let's talk about media companies. You were on the board of the New York Times. And now, it's so delightful to have Washington Post people here tonight, right? Come on, guys. I've given him some backpacks to give to his kids so he can see the other paper, the bigger paper, we would say here. Okay, but do you think there is a way out for media? I mean, will it take this legislation? You know, people around here believe and are reporting that there'll be fines for Facebook next week, Facebook, Google, who knows? There's actually going to be action. Do you think that there will be any kind of change? And how do you save newspapers and news organizations?
A lot there. So let's talk just for a moment about fines. And this is an example of how we've lost the script. We fine Facebook $3 to $5 billion for blatantly violating consent decrees, basically blatantly violating the law. And we said, we're angry. We're going to fine you $3 to $5 billion, which is the equivalent of 7 days of top-line income or 7 weeks of cash flow. If I put a parking meter in front of your house that costs $100 every 15 minutes, but the ticket was 25 cents, you would break the law. And what we have done is we have actively and explicitly encouraged these companies to continue to break the law. And the question is, well, who's the guilty party here? And the answer is they're not the guilty party. They're doing their job. This unbelievable agent of capitalism, the greatest source of good in the history of mankind, democracy on top of capitalism, for-profit entities are a really powerful engine of that. And their job is to grow their earnings. And they're doing their job. You know who's not doing their job? Us. We're not electing the officials who put in place the safeguards and the referees like we put in place across every other industry. If the Washington Post could reverse engineer, if we could reverse engineer the content of the Washington Post to an 80% increase in emergency room visits among teen girls who are self-cutting, or a 120% increase in teen suicide among young girls who we've put weapons of mass destruction in their hands. Boys bully physically and verbally. Girls bully relationally. And we have literally put nuclear weapons in their hands with these social media platforms. If I could reverse engineer what you are doing to teen depression, you would be in a world of hurt. A world of hurt. But for some reason, we've decided when it's obvious that these companies are doing the same thing, we seem to take it past because they're innovators. They're the Jesus Christ of our era. As a society becomes more educated and wealthier, its reliance on religion goes down. But we still have these huge questions, these need for idols. Who's the Jesus Christ of our information economy? Who Kara interviewed 2 decades ago? Steve Jobs, an individual who denied his own blood, under oath, perjured himself to avoid child support payments when he was worth $250 million.
Who was that?
Did I hear that, or am I having a stroke?
Who was that? Is that Hillary? Come up here.
Anyways, so my sense is...
Well, that was a showstopper.
Yeah.
Who is it? Identify yourself.
That took the wind out of my sails.
Yeah. Hillary, I knew it. Come on over here. Come on.
I have a fucking roll, man.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, I was about to drop an F-bomb, and I was going to say that the key to a better future is more engaged fathers, not a better fucking phone. But anyways, we have decided that these companies are not subject to the same scrutiny.
People in Washington don't talk like this.
God, no? Does that mean stop?
Well, that's what Kara said. That's why it's so good. But people in Washington are so discreet about it. I love it.
Thank you for saying that. And thanks for hosting.
Well, you talk
I like
about...
literally my mind is a blank.
Right. Okay, well, let me bring you back because we've got some great entrepreneurs in the room. Steve and Jean Case,
yep.
Jim Bankoff at Vox, Susan yep. Tynan from Framebridge. There's others here. I see Jane from Brand Guild and Danielle's here from Uber. You've got a lot of people. Tim is here. Tim's, by the way, look what Tim is doing. Tim is, what are you doing? Mapping the skies. Oh, sure. On your way home. Mapping the skies. So you have some entrepreneurs here. Because yep. one of the things that you talk about, I listen to you with Kara every week on Pivot. If you guys don't, it's so great. But make sure you're not in the car with your kids because you're laughing too hard. Then you're crying and then you're nervous. And you're also looking things up while you're driving. All those things are bad, right? But we do have some entrepreneurs in the room. But you're also talking about the fact that there aren't that many opportunities now. I mean, could Steve start AOL now?
Well, yeah, Steve could, but yeah. The rest of us can't. So look, here's the bottom line. Let's talk about entrepreneurship. 2/3 of jobs in America are created by small companies. 30 years ago, 15% of companies out there were less than 1 year old. Now it's 7%. We talk about this as if it's an era of innovation. We're living in an era of non-innovation. There were twice as many companies being formed every day in the Carter administration than are being formed now. Why? Because the fastest growing parts of our economy, well, let's think, search, social, digital marketing, tech hardware, are controlled by monopolies. Let's try and start a search engine. There hasn't been a social media network of any substance founded since 2011 because we have monopolies that suck the oxygen out of the air, that literally have crawlers, as Facebook does, that goes out there to look at the engagement of every app, and the moment an app gets engagement, they rip off the features, and if that doesn't stop it, they go and acquire it. One of the greatest legislative failures, or FTC or DOJ, who finally have welcomed from their slumber, welcome back, guys, was letting Instagram go through. How on earth did they let that happen? But yet we wring our hands over AT&T buying Time Warner. The FTC and the DOJ and all these attorney generals get upset about Sprint and T-Mobile bringing together 130 million people, but we're encrypting the backbone of 2.7 billion? Oh, but don't let T-Mobile and Sprint merge. I mean, it's literally as if there's one set of standards for everybody else and one set of standards for these guys. So what do we have here? The fastest growing parts of our economy are basically impossible to start a business in. These companies perform infanticide on small promising companies and prematurely euthanize big companies, which tend to be better taxpayers and better employers. Walmart has paid $68 billion in federal income tax over the last 10 years. Amazon has paid $1.4 billion, despite the fact that Amazon added the value of Walmart in 3 months to its market cap in 2018. A society can't function. We can't pay for this young man to stand watch for us if our most successful companies don't pay taxes. And they're doing their job. Their job's to avoid taxes. But what does it mean when the most valuable company in the world, which it will be in the next 48 hours, doesn't pay any taxes? How do we function? What it means is taxes are a zero-sum game. It means the rest of us pay more. Alexa, is this a good thing?
Yeah, a lot of...
I'm sorry. Back to happiness.
Back to happiness. I started to say that I think... Right.
Anyway, that's about happiness.
But
sorry.
I do want to talk about. Yeah, what does it take to be happy?
Okay,
thank
so
you,
I'll
Kara.
Give you. So this is a personal journey. This may come as a shock, but I struggle with mild depression and anger. And the motivation for the book was about 3 years ago. My sister, who I speak to every Sunday night, said, "Why are you so angry all the time? You have less justification to be angry." So this is. Been a personal journey to try and get my blessings to foot to my mood, which it doesn't a lot of the time. So this has been an exploration of other people's research. I don't say professor on the title because I have no academic credibility in the field. So I did a lot of research, though, of other great clinical and social psychologists. So I do think you can distill it down to some best practices. I don't think there's any silver bullet. I don't think anyone who tells you this is how you're happy in less than a few minutes, it should be trusted. But there are some best practices. So I'll give you, and I try to distill it down to a few basic equations. And I focus mostly on young people. The ratio of time you spend sweating to watching other people sweat is a forward-looking indicator of your happiness and your success. So show me someone who watches ESPN 2 hours a night and then watches football all day on Sunday, and I'll show you a future of failed relationships and anger. Show me someone who figures out a way to do SoulCycle, sweat, CrossFit, play sports with other people and uses spectator sports as a means of entrenching or reinforcing relationships with their loved ones, and I'll show you someone who's successful at life. Nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems, and this has been a huge source of relief of anxiety for me. The one piece of advice that seniors would give to their younger selves is they wish they'd been less hard on themselves. Not that they've changed their career, not that they'd been more successful, but in the moment, the perception of everything is dramatically greater to the upside and the downside. When you kill it and you start thinking you're the bomb, realize a lot of that isn't your fault. And at the same time, when you screw up and things aren't going well or you've really messed up, also realize it's not entirely your fault and this too shall pass. A young person, I can predict your income based on two things. Your pedigree, we have a caste system in the United States, it's called college, and unfortunately it's directly correlated to your parents' income. Show me a woman coming out of Dartmouth, living in New York, I'll show you someone who's making $150,000 a year by the time they're 30. Show me someone who's dropped out of junior college in Little Rock. They'll be lucky if they make $50,000. I'll skip forward to the kind of like the one big hack. The only award I've ever wanted my whole life. In high school, I won Most Comical. I've successfully navigated every accolade and reward award since then. I really want to be best teacher at Stern. It's like I'm so nakedly in pursuit of this award. I'm very good at what I do. I deserve the damn award. There's 200 faculty, and every year they nominate 5 professors for this thing, and I've been nominated like 9 times. But unfortunately, But unfortunately, there's this Jesus Christ of teaching named Aswath the Motor, and it teaches valuation. He's a genius, and every year he wins it. But biology is my friend, and he's getting really old. And he's retiring. So last year they called me in and said, the dean called me and said, I know this is really important to you, so I wanted to be the first to let you know that this year's Teacher of the Award is Glenn Okun. And he said, however, the kids have asked you to do their last class, and they want you on the Algebra of Happiness. This is where all the graduates get together and say, we want to have one professor do the last class. And their MBAs, they want to hack. They're like, we know you've written a book on this. We're busy. What is the secret? And I'm like, well, there's no one secret. They're like, okay, well, what is, if you had to distill it down to one thing? And my best attempt to distill all of this research down, I can do two things. The largest study of its kind on happiness is the Harvard Grand Study. And they tracked 400 males from 1929 to 10 years ago, from the age of 19 to, they all died. Last one died when he was 99. Which says a lot about the way we were thinking 80 years ago. We decided to track the happiness of just 400 men. Let's not worry about women's happiness, but that's another talk show. And they measured everything from their diet, their job, their activities, their relationships, and then queried them every week on how satisfied they were. And then they tried to look at all this data and suss out what were the drivers of the people in the happiest decile and the least happy. Now, worst practice, the thing that was most common in the decile, the lowest decile of happiness, anyone want to guess? Yeah, what is the worst practice in happiness? This one factor was more prevalent in people who were least happy through the course of their life. Not ambition. All the latest research says connection and loneliness is the new cancer, but that's not what the Harvard Grant study found.
Okay, you should know.
Okay.
Sally Quinn is standing next to you, and you know Ben Bradley, her husband, was part of that study, and she wrote about it.
There you go.
So I know what the answer to happiness.
What's
the
that?
The answer to happiness is love. Sure. Full stop.
You're stealing my thunder. Thank you. Let's talk about worst practice. The one thing, and this is do as I do as I say, not as I do, the worst practice is alcohol. It was more prevalent in relationships coming off the track, poor health, careers coming undone. The best practice is simple. The people who are happiest have the broadest set of deep and meaningful relationships. At work, do you feel respected, admired? And do you respect and admire other people? Amongst your friends, do you get a sense of joy and camaraderie? And just as importantly, do you know they feel a sense of joy and camaraderie from you at home? Amongst your family, do you feel intense levels of love and support? And again, just as importantly, do you know they know that they are intensely loved and supported? And it's got the best opening line of any academic study in history. Academic studies aren't a lot of fun to read. It's a 400-page report. And the opening sentence on the line of the third principal scientist in charge of the study, because they kept dying, is happiness is love, full stop. And so the hack is the following. All business is based on biology. All biology, all happiness, unhappiness, I think is based on astrophysics. That's kind of where all the answers are. And the universe, if you were to look at all that astrophysics, it kind of lands in one place. The universe wants to prosper. When a sun dies, it catalyzes a set of chemical reactions such that in a few hundred million years, a new sun emerges that's stronger, brighter, hotter. The universe wants to prosper. So it puts in place a series of incentives to make sure that the next generation is smarter, faster, right, stronger, and survives. So food is wonderful. We have incentives to eat. Sex and affection are joyous. We have incentives to propagate. But the number one source of prosperity is, quite frankly, is caregiving. And that is going all in on someone else's well-being, or what you would refer to as complete love. And as a result, the incentives are there. And there's three types of love. There's the love you get as a child, the unrequited love you get from other people. There's transactional love, which quite frankly is the majority of love in this room, and that is we enter into partnerships with people to try and get intimacy or support in exchange for our love. But the people who tend to be the happiest, because the universe sees them as the most important people in the world, are the people that manage to put themselves, and this is what I tell the kids, your goal is to put yourself in a place spiritually, psychologically, and economically such that you can find one or more other people to love completely. It's the caregivers that win. I like that.
Scott, that's so beautiful. And you've inspired us, by the way. And we have Dog Tag Bakery, which is
awesome.
Our friend Connie Milstein has this famous brownie recipe for disabled veterans and spouses. We teach them how to bake, and
nice.
Georgetown University teaches them how to be entrepreneur. Oh, maybe you ought to do that at NYU. Let's think about that. Okay. And the food was made, thank you, is that good? The food was made by Foodini. These are all refugee immigrants. I hope you all enjoy the food. And I think you've really hit on something, and it's such a delight to have you here. And Kara, I just want to say your podcast, it is really, this is like the anti-love thing. You know, my kids know we wait for your podcast to hit on Friday. I don't like it when it's late. I like to be at the same time. Jim, maybe I should talk to Jim about that. And we all stop, and everyone in my family lives in a podcast. Thank you for doing
that.
Thank you for being here.
This.
Please
Thank
enjoy
so
the rest of
coming.
The party.